Welcome to the IBJ podcast for the week of September 13th, 2021, brought to you by First Person Advisors, a division of NFP. I'm Leslie Weidenbender, the editor of IBJ, and this week we're turning the microphone over to IBJ Sports business reporter Mickey Shuey for a conversation with Dale Neuberger. Dale is a former president of the Indiana Sports Corp and treasurer of FINA, the International Federation for Aquatics. He spent several weeks in Japan for the Olympic Games this summer, where he served as the International Olympic Committee's competition director for swimming, with additional responsibilities for diving, water polo, artistic swimming, and open water swimming. Mickey talked with Dale about his experiences in Tokyo and what Indiana can learn from them. Here's their conversation.
So I am joined by Dale Neuberger, the former head of the Indiana Sports Corp and a longtime player in the Indianapolis sports management consultancy arena. He has since retired from that, but he recently got back from a trip to Tokyo, and he's here to tell us all about that. So Dale, tell us what you were doing in Tokyo from late July to early August.
Well, I was the technical delegate for swimming, as appointed by the International Olympic Committee and FINA, the International Federation for Aquatics. And in that role, I'm the competition director. I'm responsible for anything that happens in the building. I'm not responsible for the food in the village or the transportation schedules, but anything that happens in the aquatic venue is under my responsibility. And it was a great experience and handled, I think, in a very good way for the athletes and for spectators worldwide.
So tell me what it was like to actually be on the ground in Tokyo during this event, because certainly not a lot of people had that opportunity.
It's unusual. It was unusual because there were no spectators at events. And one would normally think that that would have a big impact on competition. But I would tell you that in terms of the athletic performances, I think the athletes were ready to compete, whether there were any spectators in the stands or not. They were ready and put on a great show across our five aquatic disciplines. We have swimming, diving, water polo, artistic swimming, and open water swimming, a total of 49 medal events. We have more medals at the Olympic Games than any sport for the first time in Tokyo. So we had 49 opportunities to shine, but also 49 opportunities where some things can go wrong, and we really came through it with perfection.
So what were some of the key challenges you faced as technical director in ensuring these games went off without a hitch, at least on the swimming side of things?
It's difficult to be in a new venue. It was a fantastic venue, probably the best aquatic facility in the world. But it's difficult to be in a venue that has never been used before and to come there a week or so before the games begin and hope that everything is perfect. And in fact, it was. But our biggest worry is really centered around the venue itself and making sure that a new facility could operate at full capacity and full efficiency. Obviously, the other element of this was the health concerns, things related to the pandemic and COVID-19, and how athletes would react to that and how the various procedures would occur over that period of time. I think thirdly, there was a good deal of concern before the games about potential demonstrations related to social issues and what athletes might do on the award stand or what they might do in the field of play. And we worried about that as to how the reaction would be, various circumstances, various scenarios that played out, none of which came to bear during the course of the games. We didn't have a single demonstration of any kind, but we planned for it, and it was certainly an area of concern going into the games.
Could you walk us through your process for managing this facility and these operations, kind of from the moment you arrived in Tokyo to the day of the first event and there forward?
Well, our preparation for the games really begins about 2 years out from the Olympics itself, where we look at the qualification procedures and how athletes will actually be qualified to enter the games because the IOC has very strict quotas. We can't exceed those quotas. And so we are involved very early on in virtually weekly activities leading into the games. But once we're there, our job is to make sure that everything is, from an athletic competition standpoint, technically perfect. So it means that we make sure that everything related to the environment, in particular the traffic pattern for when athletes come from the training area or their team preparation area to a call room, to competition, to mixed zone, electronic media, drug testing, award stand, and press conference afterwards. So there's a very complex set of procedures that athletes go through as part of their routine, from the moment they leave the team preparation area to the time they finish a press conference after being a medalist at the Olympic Games. And our job is to make sure that every element of that process works perfectly and seamlessly for athletes, some of whom have more than one event in an evening.
You talked about the assumption that many had that the games could be affected by the lack of fans in attendance. Walk me through what you saw from athletes and how they coped with that when they were either getting ready for competition or even on the award stage waiting to receive their medals. I mean, typically they get to gawk at all the fans cheering for them as a result of that, and they really didn't have that this year, right?
Sure, it was a very different experience for athletes in terms of what occurred after the race. So that the usual applause and cheering and fanfare that would occur after a race, especially if it was a record-setting performance, it didn't occur. So many of the things that you would associate with a winning performance didn't take place. And that meant that there was no one in the stands to cheer for them other than their teammates and coaches and other team personnel. So it was very different for them in that regard. But I think everything before that was very similar to what their experience was otherwise. Because in essence, what athletes are told by their coaches is, you need to be ready to compete whenever and wherever the circumstances dictate. And that may be in outdoor facilities, it might be impacted by weather. In this case, it was impacted by 1 year because of the pandemic. But coaches preach to athletes, be ready at the moment that you need to be ready, because no one is interested that you were ready a week ago or you'll be ready a week later than the games occur. It's a matter of competing at that moment. So I think everything before the race is very similar. Everything after the race was very dissimilar, a reaction in which athletes didn't have the opportunity to get fan response and the adulation that comes from a winning performance.
What will take you and your people to the stratosphere? News, learning ops, and insights from the benefits, compensation, and people experts at First Person Advisors, now a subsidiary of NFP. Subscribe to The Boost for weekly updates at firstpersonadvisors.com/boost.
Now, in this week's edition of IBJ, you have a guest column that essentially tackles the question of, are there lessons to be learned from this Olympic experience that could benefit Indianapolis in the long term for future event selection, bidding, and hosting events? I know that the answer for you is, as you put it, decidedly yes. Kind of give me an overview of your takeaways from where Indianapolis could stand to learn some things.
Well, I think every time I'm at an event, there is a learning process that takes place. And I think that's true for Indiana Sports Corporation leadership and in the way that they conduct themselves throughout their experience across many sports. But we always look at things that occur and say, is that a practice that we'd like to replicate later? Or that was interesting or that was beneficial, we ought to take note of that and make sure that we do that at the next opportunity. And I think there were several things that struck me about the experience in Tokyo that are takeaways for Indianapolis, but takeaways for sport generally. So it's not meant to be in any manner of preaching to anyone about what can or should take place. It's really the lessons we've all learned as a result of an Olympic Games under unusual circumstances. One of those, obviously, is that health and safety concerns are going to be paramount. And we saw that during the Final Four here in Indianapolis in March, 68 teams, all of the procedures that needed to take place to ensure a healthy environment for the athletes and team personnel and others associated with the universities. And those same things were in play in Tokyo, just at a larger scale. There were 11,200 athletes, 206 countries. So again, the nationalities probably made it more difficult overall than the circumstance here in the United States, where largely the athletes competing in the Final Four in the basketball tournament were from the United States. So that was a little bit more difficult, obviously. But health and safety will be paramount. And we have to make sure that whatever we do, we talk a lot about athlete first and about the athlete perspective and making sure that we do events in a way that honors athletes and their needs. And we really need to live that even more so than any of us have done before, because now the athletes and their safety and their ability to compete under equal circumstances is so important to the sanctity of sport and the ability for sport to go forward in a good way.
So as part of the Tokyo Olympics, every athlete, every person who was involved in the games, to my understanding, had to be tested and kind of go through this intake process, if you will. Could you walk us through that and help us understand what it was like to be inside that massive bubble, if you will?
It was unique. I have to say that I've been through nothing like it before. So for us, 96 hours and 72 hours before arrival in Japan, we had to have COVID tests here in Indianapolis. So two tests prior to getting on the plane. Then at arrival at the airport in Tokyo, we're tested again. So you don't get to baggage claim until you've been tested and your results have come back from that test. So after spending about 5 or 6 hours in the airport waiting for the results, and obviously with a massive number, I think there were about 42,000 individuals connected with the Olympic Games who came through the two Tokyo airports. After then leaving the airport every day for the 22 days I was in Tokyo, were tested. And the procedure was to have a saliva tube that we had that had a coded ID number, and we had to submit that every day by 6 o'clock with saliva to be tested for everybody connected with the Olympic Games. And that meant not only the athletes themselves and the team personnel, but all of the others surrounding it. That meant contractors and those vendors and others associated with the games itself. So about 40 to 50,000 tests per day that the Tokyo authorities were doing, and we needed to be tested each time. We were not allowed to leave our hotel. Our only places of activity were either the hotel or the aquatic venue. There was nothing in between that. So for the first 14 days, we couldn't use even the fitness facilities in the hotel. We couldn't eat in the restaurant. We ate in a banquet room that was associated just with our group. So the procedures were stringent, and it was very different. And again, this is something that was necessitated by the pandemic, and to also to make sure that all of us did not do anything that might compromise the health and safety of the athletes themselves. So I've looked at it, and people have said, well, boy, that must have been very difficult, and how did you endure that? And what you think about is truly that, for me, it's a privilege. It's a privilege to be there. I said when I spent 5 or 6 hours in the airport waiting for our results after a long journey, you know, to get there, it's a privilege to have a chance to do this. Very few get a chance to do it. And our job is to do it in a way that is going to make sure that a few billion people who are watching on broadcast around the world have a chance to see athletes at their very best. And so what we have to endure is really just a small fraction of what the athletes had to endure in the athlete village, where you think about the risks that go along with, again, 15,000 or so people in the village, including team personnel, 206 countries, and all the risks that they were undergoing. Here we were, and these were things that were necessary for us to have a great competition. Cumbersome and burdensome and so on, but necessary, and as I say, a privilege and an honor to have a chance to do it.
How does this opportunity compare to all the others that you've experienced during your career? I know that you were involved in a multitude of events for Indiana Sports Corp, including, I believe, the World Basketball Games in 2002. How does this rank?
I think international competition is very special because you have an opportunity to for events in Indianapolis to showcase our city and the internationalization of our city and its image worldwide. And so during my tenure, having a World Rowing Championship, a World Swimming Championship, a World Basketball Championship, as well as events like the Solheim Cup, and being involved in Pan American Games before that and so on, these were very special occasions. I have to say, in my volunteer work, being able to participate in Olympic Games is an exceptionally special experience. This is my 11th Olympic Games in one manner or another, starting as a standing room only spectator in Montreal in 1976 to being on the pool deck as the competition director for 4 Olympic Games over this last period of time since Beijing. Each of those is special, and each of those gives one the understanding of how important sport is, not just to the athletes and those connected with the competition itself, but as we tell our officials before our first session, we say not to make anyone more nervous about what they do or apprehensive, but what happens in this venue today, there will be a couple of billion people around the world who care about the result. And we need to do it right. We need to do it correctly. It magnifies the importance. And therefore, we understand that there is no room for anything less than perfection. And that's a high standard, but that's the standard that we set for itself.
Going back to the lessons that Indianapolis can learn, if you had a conversation with Ryan Vaughn today, the current president of the Indiana Sports Corp, what would you tell him is kind of the main priority that Indianapolis should focus on of the four that you lay out between attention to health and safety, environmental issues, focusing on the athlete, and discipline and persistence?
Well, I don't give any instructions to Ryan Vaughn, who's done an incredible job as president of Indiana Sports Corporation. He's doing it in an exceptional way, and my only conversation would be with him about some experiences from the Tokyo Olympic Games and what they might mean for Indianapolis. As I've said, I think health and safety issues are going to be exceedingly important as we go forward. I don't think this is a one-time occurrence. And the partnerships and alliances that were put together for the Final Four and the basketball tournament in March in Indianapolis, those partnerships and alliances should remain in place because there will be other important health issues that come forward, and we need to have those in place. I've said also that the environmental issues are going to be increasingly important in the way that governing bodies select cities for event hosting, but also in the way that the world views the success of an event. And so we can't ignore the impact of the environment that our events bring, but also the ways in which we can instruct and help others see the importance of making sure that our environment is respected. I've said also that the focus on athletes that we've always had for events in Indianapolis, from the very first event, my involvement back in 1982, the National Sports Festival, coming here as a newcomer, so impressed with the athlete first mentality. But we can't lose that. We can't ever forget it. It's about them and not about us. And when we do that, then the event is truly successful. And then lastly, there will be constantly naysayers and doomsayers along the way who tell us about the terrible things that are going to occur. The reality is that the Olympic Games were panned by so many critics before they took place about this being the super spreader event and all of the terrible results that would occur from it. It just plain and simply didn't happen. And we had, you know, a very small number. Only 29 athletes tested at the airport out of 42,000 visitors who had were tested positive and then were quarantined and isolated and so on until the time of being able to compete. And then even in the athlete village, just a handful, less than three dozen athletes who tested positive over 20 or 22 days of living in the village. So we have to get used to the fact that people are going to look at the doom and gloom, look at the negative aspects and so on. And we have to get ourselves out of that and say, the glorious elements of this, what the athletes experienced, this was a fantastic Olympic Games. The Japanese authorities, governmental authorities, and health authorities did a phenomenal job. I'm not sure anywhere in the world could have done what they did. And so therefore, there's a respect for that and an acknowledgement and recognition of an incredible performance by them to make this happen. But we're going to need to do that every time. You know, I think COVID-19 is not a once-in-a-lifetime circumstance. I think we're going to have other circumstances, maybe not quite the same, but others that will test us in similar ways. And we just need to be ready for that, as we were for the Final Four in the men's basketball tournament in March, but to continue to be able to have those partnerships and alliances that made that possible.
So now that Tokyo's out of the way, what do you have coming down the pike? I understand that you're involved in the Paris Games in 2024, is that correct?
I am and will be. I'll have the same role as competition director, technical delegate in Paris 2024. But the two projects that are most important to the leadership of Paris city government, as well as Paris 2024 organizing committee, one is a Learn to Swim program for the 16 million people who live in and around Paris, and to make sure, especially for immigrant families, those who've come to the country and to the city in recent years in particular, that they are safe in and around water and can enjoy aquatic and water activities. And the second is the cleaning of the Seine. You know, since 1923, it's been illegal to swim in the Seine. And Mayor Hidalgo has indicated that her primary goal for Paris 2024 Olympic Games is the cleaning of the Seine. FINA has its open water competition, 10K races for men and women, 2 hours in the water in the Seine near the Arc de Triomphe, and we will have competition. And so the cleaning of the Seine is going to be a very important element of that. I'm involved in both of those projects, as well as setting the competition calendar and schedule for the swimming competition in Paris. And so our work begins anew for something now that's just 3 years away, not the traditional cycle of 4 years. So we look at it as if it's just around the corner, meaning it's 3 years away.
Well, Dale, thank you so much for joining us on this week's edition of the IBJ podcast. You can read Dale's entire column in this week's edition. Hope you have a great day, Dale.
Thanks very much, Mickey. It's a pleasure.
Thanks to Dale and to Mickey. In addition to Dale's column, this week's paper also has a story about the latest player in the local SPAC space. Brad Bostic of HC1.com is trying to raise $200 million through a new blank check company, also called a special purpose acquisition company. John Russell reports Bostic's SPAC is targeting disruptors in the health tech field in hopes of taking one public. Also in this week's IBJ, Emily Ketterer has more on John Mutz's latest passion project, funding research to help reinvent and bolster business models for local news outlets. You can read these stories and more at IBJ.com. Mason King will return next week.